Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Shirley Kazuo Muramoto is a California-based koto performer and teacher, and she also created Hidden Legacy, the story of the Japanese traditional performing arts in the American World War II internment camps. In this episode, she performs some incredibly beautiful koto music, and there are wonderful stories with each composition. Like all my episodes, this is available as both video and podcast. And for those of you watching the video, you'll notice that Shirley generously re-recorded one of her performances of a very special piece. If you want to jump straight to some music or different topics in our conversation, you can use the timestamps. However, I encourage you to listen to the whole episode with Shirley's engaging insights about family and identity. You can also read the transcript. Everything is linked in the description to my website, leahroseman.com, where you can sign up for my newsletter and get exclusive sneak peeks for upcoming episodes. Hi, Shirley. Thanks so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, Leah, for inviting me to be here.
Now, you're sitting there with your koto, and not everybody listening to this can see. Some people are listening to the podcast. So if you could just describe briefly the instrument and play a little bit for us before we get into our conversation, that would be wonderful.
Oh, all right. Well, the koto is a national instrument of Japan. It came from China in about the 8th century. And then it went through Korea and Okinawa and went through different changes. But basically, the traditional koto that we play in Japan these days has remained unchanged. So it's pretty much the way it's been for all those centuries. It has 13 strings, and I don't know if you can see it, but you know, it's kind of like this, and it resembles a dragon, right? The dragon is a very auspicious creature in Asian culture, right? So it's looked upon as something, a good luck thing. So even the parts of the koto are named after dragon parts, like, you know, the part over here is the head, the inside section, they call the dragon's tongue. This back section is the spine of the dragon, right? It kind of looks like it with these tuning bridges. And very end is the tail, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hollow, right? You know, if you want to see, there's sound holes here. There's one on the top and then the one at the end. So it's pretty resonant, right? Yeah, and of course, you know, just like, you know, the harp, strings resonate. So, right, it has this kind of quality that just keeps on ringing, you know. And these strings originally were made of silk, right? And but since silk is nowadays, it's a little bit difficult to have silk strings on for any long period of time, they've made a nylon version called Tichon. And these last longer for more modern pieces now that are require the strings to be strung tighter. These are much better for holding up to that. So I think that's generally about the koto instrument itself. I use 3 finger picks here on my right hand. And even these fingers sometimes without picks. And then I also use my left hand without picks. So you get a different textures. You know, if I use either hand, I can bend notes. Right. Or, right. You know, let's see. That's by pressing on the other side of the bridges. The bridges are tunable by moving them back and forth, right? So, and because of the finger picks, I can get a myriad of different tonalities. I can swish them right on the strings because the strings are actually wound. It's not just like a one piece. So I do a rap thing, you know, kind of thing, because you can slip your finger picks underneath the strings, right? And do a lot of different techniques, scraping, right? That kind of scraping technique. We generally don't play the other side of the koto. We tune the right side of the koto, but nowadays there's many other uses for also the other side of the koto. Yeah, so that's a little brief overview of things that you can play on the koto, right?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So yeah, if we could start with some music and then we can get into some interesting conversation and come back to music later, that would be great.
Okay. Can we take a moment then? Because I'm going to put this,
of course,
thing on my picks. Mm-hmm. I wanted to play something kind of a little bit active. Mm-hmm. And if you don't put something kind of sticky on your fingers, it'll fall off.
Okay.
Yeah. My mom was a teacher. And so the traditional thing is to use egg whites.
Okay.
Right. And then I thought, after a while, the egg whites get a little icky. So I'm using fake eyelash glue.
Tricks of the trade.
Yeah. I mean, people use different things now. You know, the Chinese version of this is called the guzheng, mm-hmm. right? They tape their finger picks on. They also use finger picks. Mm-hmm. And they tape it on with it's like an adhesive, you know, what do you call it? No, it's like surgical tape or something like that, right? You know, tape it onto their fingers every time. Mm-hmm. So, right. Yeah, there's various types of zithers in Asia that are pretty similar to each other. The Chinese version has steel strings, usually more strings, like 20-something strings. Mm-hmm. The Korean is kayugam. The Vietnamese is danchan. Mm-hmm. And the Korean version, they don't use any finger picks. It's all, you know, your bare fingers, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, the koto actually has other versions as well. They have a bass koto that's 17 strings. Nowadays, the more modern version of koto has 20 some odd strings. So, and at one time, the famous blind composer Michio Miyagi made a 88 string koto to try to mimic the piano. Right? Yeah, it wasn't played too often. But yeah, so okay, so I thought I'd play a version of Sakura, which is the most traditional song from Japan. It means cherry blossoms, right? And so there, you'll hear many versions of Sakura if you go to Japan. This version is by Kimio Eto. He was also a blind musician, right? And I'm sure a lot of people don't remember him, but he came over here in the late 50s. And before that, he would perform with American GIs after World War II. So he started getting some Western influence in his music, right? And he even somehow met some pretty auspicious musicians like Harry Belafonte. He was on one of his albums. Mm-hmm. There was a composer named Henry Cowell. He's a California composer that liked to incorporate ethnic instruments in his compositions. So he struck up a friendship with him, right, for a bit. And Henry Cowell wrote a piece called something for koto and orchestra, the first concerto or something. And Kimio Eto had to learn his part in Braille because he's blind, right? Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So he was on a couple of variety shows back in the day, the Danny Kaye show, which maybe people don't remember. I don't know Danny Kaye, but he was mm-hmm. a entertainer during that time. And I actually met him when I was about 9 years old. Mm-hmm. And I tagged along on a lesson that my mom was having with him in San Jose, California, when he came to perform. And I was just really influenced by by his playing and his compositions. I told my mom I wanted to take a lesson too, and she said, "You're too young." So, I just kind of went on this lifelong journey to try to find him in Japan. After I think about, you know, in the early 70s, he went back to Japan and never came back to the United States. So I loved his music so much that every time I went to Japan, I tried to get anything that was written by him. Mm-hmm. And this piece that I'm going to play is one of the pieces on something like maybe three or four albums that he did in the United States. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize, you know, they've come out with some printed books of his compositions now. It seems like that was something that was not really, you know, worked on as much, right? But now people are starting to realize and notice him more.
Okay.
That he's passed away, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So this is a version of Sakura I've been looking for most of my life. I mean, I loved it so much, I actually transcribed it from one of his records. So when I saw the printed version, it's a little bit different from the recording. And after I was researching whatever he played, I noticed that every time he played even his own compositions, he changed them up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I told his son that I wanted to record it the way I heard it on his LP. And so this is the way I've learned it, and I perform it these days.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow. So beautiful. Thank you, Shirley.
Oh, thank you.
I was just thinking that arrangement has so much interest and so much texture, mm-hmm. and it must have been so much work and really a work of love and dedication to do that transcription.
Oh, yeah, it was. I mean, I every time I went to Japan, I looked for him, right? And he was kind of an eccentric person. Mm-hmm. What I heard about later on was, you know, because he did these maybe outside of the box things for the tradition mm-hmm. that he might have been kicked out of the school, right? And so that's why he made his own school in Japan. Mm-hmm. He got into some trouble, I think, when he was in the States, which is why he couldn't come back, I think.
Okay.
I don't know all the details. But he was a genius, composer, performer, you know, a lot of these techniques are not traditional koto techniques, mm-hmm. right? And even my mother would say, well, you know, he's blind, so he can do all those things, right? But I said, that's no excuse, right? We should be able to also, you know, work hard enough to be able to play, you know, these techniques. So mm-hmm. It took a long time to figure out. Even the tuning is a little bit kind of a hybrid tuning. Okay. This is not the traditional. It's part of the traditional scale, but he changed it up, you know, and so he's able to do some different things with the composition, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So a lot of his works are just incredibly beautiful and difficult. Excuse me. Yeah.
Well, I had discovered you through actually Destiny Muhammad, the jazz harpist, because mm-hmm. she's a guest and her episode will be released before yours. So people mm-hmm. hopefully will have heard that episode. Mm-hmm. And then I saw it was a jazz koto. So I was completely fascinated. And I had it in my mind to definitely find a koto player. So I was delighted when you agreed to come and do this today. Mm-hmm. You got into playing in different styles. Was that early on or with your son, Brian? How did that happen for you?
You know, I grew up playing the koto because my mother's a koto mm-hmm. teacher. And I think the way koto is taught, you basically learn a certain style or, you know, whatever school you're with. Mm-hmm. That school usually nowadays is... has works by a main composer, right? And the main composer of my mother's koto school was Chikushi Katsuko, who's for a long time the only woman composer on the koto, right?
Okay.
Right. And when I grew up with it, I learned, of course, the traditions, which is basically you only play the music of your school. You know, you don't play music from other people's schools, and it's even frowned upon to perform with them or, you know, do things together with people from other schools, right? So the tradition is, you know, pretty. It used to be very strict, mm-hmm. and you know, it didn't really encourage creativity. Right. You know, if you wanted to compose your own music, then if it's going to be a lot of music, they would tell you to form your own school. Right. The kind of thing. Teachers weren't really encouraged to do anything outside of the box, per se. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and, you know, I'm a fourth generation American. And I was growing up playing all this Japanese music and thinking like, wow, this is. I wish I could do something else with it, mm-hmm. right? And even from my koto school, new music was coming out, right? The son of the headmaster, it was a guitarist. His name was Ichiro, mm-hmm. Ichiro Sakamoto, and he started writing music for the koto, pretty much based on his guitar, right? Mm-hmm. His guitar techniques, his, you know, understanding of Western music. And we started getting pieces like tangos, you know, Persian Market, the Third Man Theme, you know, things like this. And so I thought, wow, this is really cool. And I'm going to start my own band, right, with this music. Mm-hmm. So in high school, I started to kind of gravitate toward trying something different with the music we were getting from him, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I'm growing up in Oakland, California. I'm exposed to, you know, actually mostly rhythm and blues and soul, but, you know, rock and, you know, all these other, you know, types of music. And I thought, there's got to be a way I can play that music on the koto, right? So it's pretty much been a long journey trying to figure this out, right? Because I didn't want to change the koto too much. I wanted to keep, you know, being able to play the techniques and work around, you know, playing in these genres without changing my tuning so much, because I realized that if I can change my tuning to Western scales, and I'm, you know, we do that sometimes, mm-hmm. but you know, to me, the soul of the koto comes from the Asian tunings that we use, mm-hmm. right? It brings out the best tone, you know, because, you know, they the strings resonate. I feel like they resonate, you know, harmoniously, right? Mm-hmm. In the Asian pentatonic scales. So my goal was to try to stay, you know, with those scales while I was playing, you know, different genres of music. Mm-hmm. So that was a skill that I've developed through the years. But, you know, at first it was, I had no clue, and everybody told me, okay, if you want to learn how to improvise in jazz or whatever, just listen to a lot of jazz, right? And, you know, and that's it. You have to listen to a lot of jazz, listen to a lot of different music and musicians to get, you know, start to get this, you know, feel for it and how you want it to come out from you, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, copying people too much, right? So... And I really couldn't copy too many people because I only have 13 strings. I don't have all the notes. If I tuned it to a Western, you know, scale, and I just played, you know, basically on those scales, I felt like I sounded too much like a, you know, a harp or a guitar. Mm-hmm. And so whenever anybody asked me to collaborate with them, and I would need more notes or something like this, I would just tell them, why don't you get a harpist or a guitarist? Because, you know, you're not going to, you know, they have more more notes than I'm going to have.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, I didn't want to get into any projects where I didn't feel like you couldn't hear the personality of the koto.
Yeah. I was just trying to remember if it was Alice Coltrane or Dorothy Ashby that had some koto on their album.
Dorothy Ashby.
It was right. Dorothy. Okay.
Oh, actually, both of them. Yeah, I think Destiny brought that out, right? And we even did one of Dorothy Ashby's Moving Finger. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I even asked Destiny if we could do a video, and that's on YouTube now. So,
yeah, I saw that.
Oh, you saw it?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so she experimented on the koto as well. I hadn't heard anything about that until Destiny told me about that. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's because I've become more used to my trying to adapt to whatever the project is, right? You know, when I heard that piece, the Moving Finger, I could hear a pentatonic scale. So I thought, okay, you know, we can do this together, right?
So for your Game of Thrones arrangement, for example, mm-hmm. was that a request, or are you a Game of Thrones fan? Had you heard the music?
I'm not a Game of Thrones fan. I had never seen it before. A lot of the arrangements that I do are, you know, it's something that kind of comes to me because, you know, Game of Thrones came to me because my students were watching it. Mm-hmm. And my students were going, oh, you have to see this Game of Thrones, right? And I didn't have Netflix, so I couldn't watch it. Everybody kept talking about it. So sometimes I make arrangements so that they can, you know, they can have more fun with the music. I thought, okay, I'll make an arrangement of Game of Thrones. And, right, it, that's what came out of that video, right? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so, you know, I have students that are multicultural these days, right? I had a student who was half Guatemalan and half African-American. And so I asked their Guatemalan mother, do you have any Guatemalan songs that you might, you know, like your daughters to learn? There were sisters that were learning from mm-hmm. me. And so she gave me a few songs that I could listen to, and I chose one that I thought would work for the koto. Mm-hmm. And I asked her if she could teach them the song, right? And she just went to town with it. She made her daughters sing that song every night before they went to bed. Mm-hmm. They learned the words. I'm pretty sure they'll never forget it, right? You know, and so when we played it, you know, they sang the song as we played it on the koto. So, and I wish I could remember what the title is, but I can't right now.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce the series, and there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now back to the episode.
So this piece is my mom's favorite piece. It's called Maboroshi o Oote. And that means memories, right? So it's a shorter piece, you know, and it's very nice. Has a more, to me, it has a Latin flavor to it, right? And you know, it's very expressive. It was interesting to me that, you know, she taught it to me in a certain way, and recently I think the school is changing the style of it, but I like the way she taught it to me, and so I kind of play it like that. Okay, so this is Maboroshi o Oote. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Oh,
thank you.
your middle name, Kazuo, is your koto name?
That's my koto name.
So who gave that to you?
Of course, you know, my parents gave me that name.
Okay.
Yeah. Music names in Japan are based on your headmaster, right? The headmaster of my school is Katsuko, right? So you take part of their name. Katsuko, I can't remember all the kanji, which is the Chinese characters. Mm-hmm. But the first character is uta, which is song.
Okay.
Okay. So my mother's professional name is Kazuko, right? And when she attained her professional name, her father told her, maybe you should have the name Kashu, right? Which was, you know, the first ka uta song, and the second character represented state, right? And in the old days, they used to call California Kashu, with you know, different character, but the pronunciation was Kashu. So he said, "Yeah, I think your name should be Kashu, right?" Sorry. And then when she came to the United States, at that time they were in Japan. Mm-hmm. She came to the United States when she was 18. This is kind of after the war. She was born in Palo Alto, but went to camp. They went to Japan after the camp and then came back here. And, you know, she married my dad. And when she went playing koto for different functions and events, the name Kashu sounded more masculine than feminine. Mm-hmm. So she decided to add the character Ko, right? A lot of women's names are, you know, Keiko or Hanako or something like that. They end in the character Ko, which actually means child. I don't know. So that what made her name Kazuko, mm-hmm. right? And when she got married, they also count the number of strokes in the characters. And they said that when they put the ko on her name, the number of strokes became more fortunate, right? Right. So it was a better thing for her. And, you know, and she and I are both spiritual people. And she believes that when she changed her name to, you know, added the ko to Kazuko, that her studio started getting bigger and she had more students and things like this, right? So my name is part of her name, right? Kazu, it's the same thing, song, state. And then yo means that you're going to carry on your, you know, a branch of.
Okay.
Right. What, right. So that's why my professional name is Kazu Yo.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your mom, when she was interned in the camp during the Second World War, how old mm-hmm. was she?
She was about 9 when they went into camp. Okay. They went to an assembly center. Her parents and her younger sister was about 3 years old. And they went to assembly center, Tanforan, California, which is near like San Mateo. I don't know if anybody knows this area, but no. and then they were sent to Topaz, Utah, mm-hmm. right? Which is kind of a desert area.
Yeah.
Right. And they spent about a year and a half there. And then they were transferred to Tule Lake, California, which is in Northern California. I don't know how much of the history you want to talk about there, but,
I think,
you know.
It's very important to talk about it. Now, I'm Canadian, so we had a similar history in Canada. People not from North America may have never heard of this history. And yeah, if you want to talk to how the Japanese Americans were treated at that time.
Oh, Canadian Japanese were treated, I hate to say it, but a lot worse than the American mm-hmm. Japanese were, I believe. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a historian, so I don't want to say the wrong things, but I know that they suffered a lot more than I think the American Japanese did. In fact, a lot of them were deported like pretty quickly to Japan. And I have a feeling that maybe because of that, they were deported pretty much, but American Japanese were not deported, right? They were a year and a half after being incarcerated, they put out this loyalty questionnaire that was supposed to be used to find out which of the young men would fight in the war. But they decided to give it to everybody who was like age 17 and older, right? Even the first generation, the older people. And there were two hot button questions on it that said something like, would you, you know, fight for the United States? And would you give up your allegiance to the emperor? That type of thing, which assumed that everybody was from Japan, right? Two-thirds of those incarcerated in the United States were American citizens. The other one-third were the first generation. And if they gave up their allegiance to the emperor, they would be, you know, without a state, without a country. Right. So so that was, of course, a very personal, very heart-wrenching decision to make on those questions. And it came down to thinking that if you said no to those questions, that you didn't want to be in the United States anymore, and they were going to deport you to Japan. My grandparents were among those people, right? They were very, you know, actually my grandparents were second generation. So they gave up their citizenship in order to leave the United States. But not everybody who signed the questionnaire no-no went to Japan, and they were not deported. You know, so a lot of them stayed here, but of course, a lot of them went to Japan.
Now, I can't remember. So we'll talk about your beautiful documentary, Hidden Legacies, but I'm not sure if it was in that I learned this or separate reading that in Hawaii, Japanese Americans were not interned, but they had very strict rules about culture, that they weren't allowed to practice Japanese culture. So it was just a different hardship. Was that in your film? I can't remember.
We touched on it. Because it was different in Hawaii because there were a lot more Japanese who were, you know, working in Hawaii, right, in the government, in companies and such. So they couldn't really take all those people and put them in camps because otherwise everything would shut down, right? They did have some camps, not as many as, you know, we did in the United States. But, you know, because they weren't put in a different place, in a prison far away in the deserts and remote areas, they were still among the cities or towns. And if they practiced anything Japanese, sometimes, you know, people would shoot into their house or whatever, right? Because they're still there. So so they pretty much had to stop doing whatever they were doing as far as Japanese cultural arts. The flip side of American Japanese being in these remote areas was that they could continue to practice traditional arts because nobody else could hear them or see them, right?
So, and the government actually paid the teachers because they realized it was keeping people from uprising, basically. It was keeping them calm because they had something to do.
They were looked at as, there was a title for them, and I can't remember now. And they were actually paid on the same scale as a doctor. So $19 a month, because they were helping to keep people occupied and doing something so that, you know, they wouldn't be thinking about causing riots or pandemonium.
So when you were growing up, your mom didn't talk to you about this time in her life.
You know, my mother was a child, so when she went into camp, so she talked about camp, But she only talked about it like camp, right? You know, she goes, I learned in camp. So, you know, I didn't know anything about that history. So I just assumed that she was talking about summer camp, you know. That's the only camp I knew. Excuse me. And, right, I didn't hear about what that camp was until later, right? And in the community, everybody talked about camp, right? They didn't say, you know, I was in this prison camp in Arizona or something, like, you know, or, you know, was it, yeah, Arizona, Colorado, Utah, right? You know, all these places where the camps were.
So how did it work with the instruments? I understand some people were able to bring instruments, but in other cases, they were incomplete or they had to be made. How did that work? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, smaller instruments like the bamboo flute, shakuhachi, or shamisen, which just kind of looks like a banjo a little bit, you know, those can be taken apart and transported, you know, pretty portably, but not the koto is 6 feet long. So, you know, when I started learning the history, I heard these, you know, phrases like they could only take what they could carry, right? And, you know, since my mom was saying I learned in camp, I thought she brought a koto to camp with her. And I said, how did you do that? I thought you could only take what you could carry. Unless you stuffed it, you know, it's hollow. Maybe you stuffed it with clothes, right? You know, so we learned after interviewing some of the musicians that were there that like one person had friends who stored their kotos for them and said, you know, wherever you end up, just let us know and we'll bring it to you.
Okay.
Right. I'm guessing this one teacher that my mom took lessons from in San Francisco, I mean, she was a teacher and she, you know, when your music is your thing, you'll find a way to bring your instrument, you know, with you, right? So I have a feeling she somehow was able to bring it with her. Mm-hmm. Somebody else said that this gentleman made a koto for his wife, right, in camp. You know, it wasn't really wonderful, but, you know, it was something she could practice on, right? Mm-hmm. And when my mom's family went to Tule Lake, you know, it became the place because, you know, all the no-nos, all the people who said no on the loyalty questionnaire were sent to Tule Lake. And a lot of them thought they were going to be deported, of course. Mm-hmm. So 2/3 of them were thinking, oh, I don't know the language. I don't know anything about Japan. So I better start learning, right?
Okay.
And there's an anthropologist, I think his name was, I know his last name is Oppler, who said that there was a resurgence of Japanese culture at Tule Lake, right? And this is because everybody thought they better know some Japanese things if they were going to be sent to Japan. So all the language classes were filled up, Japanese language, right? And of course, you know, cultural arts. So my mom was able to, you know, actually, I think my grandpa got one of the kotos for my mother. So she's able to practice on something and it had no strings and no bridges. So he got some raffia and tied it, you know, end to end. So it was long enough to stretch over 6 feet. And then he made little bridges out of pieces of wood and toothbrush handles, right? So she had something to practice on. Yeah, so, you know, people were very, very creative. I mean, they made finger picks out of cow bones or chicken bones, pieces of wood sometimes, right? Henry Cowell, who I mentioned before, was a very good friend of a shakuhachi player in Manzanar. And his name was Kitaro Tamada. His letters to Mr. Cowell are the only Issei first generation voice that we had in the film. But, you know, I don't know if that letter got in. There was one letter that asks Mr. Cowell if he can get some strings for the koto players. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were gut strings. So I thought, wow, that's a long piece of gut. Did they really have, you know, I mean, I guess are bass string basses made of that kind of string? No, right?
Well, they used to be. So people mm-hmm. who play like viola da gamba and like original instrument style violins, they use gut strings oh. and I made from sheep gut. So I imagine, you know, intestines are quite long. So yes, bass would have been made, yeah. I think, out of gut. What was the process of making that film like for you?
It was really an eye-opening experience to me because, you know, I just had this little bit of information from my mother. And then when I tried to find more information from other people, it was just like not non-existent. And mm-hmm. even when I went to some of the institutions that were that had grant funding and such, they thought, you know, I just didn't do enough research. But, you know, that somebody must have done it by now, right? kind of thing. Because after there were reparations, I think it was 1988 that Ronald Reagan signed the reparations for Japanese Americans. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of, you know, put a spotlight on that history and wanting to know more about it. That's kind of why I think reparations for African Americans are also something that needs to happen because of what happened, you know, what after Japanese Americans received reparations, it received the attention it needed on that mm-hmm. history. And but it was interesting to me that the history was being shaped too, right? Because mm-hmm. Japanese Americans, of course, you know, they were, you know, upset to find out that even if you were born here, they didn't receive the same protections as anybody, you know, other people born in the United States, right? And so they wanted to make sure that they were accepted into this society, right?
When I was reading about the no-no questionnaire mm-hmm. In an article, uh-huh. from what I understood, for those people who were born in Japan who were not born in the United States, that they were not eligible for American citizenship. So if they said we're not loyal to the Emperor of Japan, they were stateless because they could not get American citizenship.
That's right.
That's which right. is shocking, yeah. really.
Yeah, and devastating.
Yeah.
See, what were we talking about before that?
the process of making the film, because you hadn't made a film before that?
No.
Or had you?
I'm not okay. a filmmaker. I mean, I guess now I am, but... But, you know, I had thought about if I was going to put something together that people could see and understand, it would have to be, to me, if I could find survivors of the mm-hmm. camp who experienced the arts in, you know, when they were there, then they can tell their stories because, you know, of course, that's different, right? To hear it from people who experienced it, you know, even though I felt like I was kind of on the later edge of capturing those stories, you know, it had to be gathered by, you know, at that time. People I went to try to get funding to try and explore that a little bit more, I didn't think that was important, right? Yeah. Because they wanted the message that went out to be that we are Americans. We are, you know, we have no foot in another country because we are loyal Americans.
Did you get funding from the American Civil Liberties Union for the film?
I got it from National Park Service.
Oh.
What do they call it? Confinement Sites Grant. I tried the California, California Library Civil Liberties, something like okay. that. They have these sessions that you can go to so that you can put your grant together in such mm-hmm. a way that, you know, they want to see it in a certain, mm-hmm. you know, voice or whatever. And one of them told me, we don't fund any music, you know, like that. I was just looking for cultural music at the time. And then I'd look at the people who were granted funding and it would be, you know, new works about the camp, like, you know, oh, this is a new composition about camp or, you know, something like this. But... But, you know, maybe they didn't want the information to go out there that people did Japanese things in camp, right? I mean, I think that's kind of what it was. That's why you saw a lot of history about, oh, they did swing music and they did, you know, they had orchestras and they had, you know, right? Anything that was more, you know, Western, but not the Japanese arts, right? So I started to, you know, think that there's a part of them that was starting to feel ashamed of being, you know, having Japanese heritage, right? And I know that, you know, immigrant communities that come to whatever country they go to, they start to assimilate into that culture, that main culture, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, we found that Japanese Americans actually assimilated 2 generations faster than everybody else because of the camp war experience.
In terms of your Japanese language, how much did you know when you went to Japan to spend 6 months there to get your teaching certification?
I didn't know too much. My parents are kind of interesting because they're both, one is a second generation Japanese who was educated in Japan. So my dad's Japanese was pretty good, and his English was not as good. He had a thick accent. Mm-hmm. My mom is a third generation and born here and spent some time in Japan after the war. Mm-hmm. So I heard Japanese growing up. I could understand it better than I could speak it. I went to Japanese school every Saturday. I wanted to speak Japanese. So when I went to college, I majored in Japanese. I went to UC Berkeley, and it was like the early 70s. So it was right after the civil rights unrest and, you know, the formulation of ethnic studies programs. You know, it was a brand new department at Berkeley, and, you know, the ethnic studies had conversational Japanese as one of the classes. They had conversational Cantonese, things like that, right? But since they were a new department, they didn't assign much credit for it. You know, you might get one unit. So I majored in Japanese because I wanted to learn Japanese. The Japanese that was taught at Berkeley was under a department called Oriental Language. Mm-hmm. Right. It was mostly classical Japanese. Right. So at that time I thought, oh, this is terrible because classical Japanese is great, but I won't be able to talk to anybody. Right. You know, even Japanese people I met from Japan would say, wow, you're learning, you know, poetry, you know, Manyoshu, Kokinshu, Tales of Genji. We don't even do that in Japan, right? So that made me think even more, I'm not going to be able to speak to anybody. But after I graduated, I took my first trip to Japan for my degree. And I wanted to speak in Japanese, like to try my Japanese, but I didn't realize that the Japanese I was hearing when I was growing up was my dad's Japanese. That's a man's Japanese. And it's a little more, you know, of course, it's more masculine. It's more your dad talking to the daughter, which is more kind of looking down. There's different levels of speaking, right? And, you know, so I get these really strange looks like, oh my gosh, who is that? She talks like a man. So when I started to realize my Japanese wasn't kosher, right, I shut up for the next 2 or 3 months, you know. I didn't want to offend anybody else. So, yeah. So it took me a while to kind of get into the language, right? And I don't speak fluently still, but when I was taking lessons at the headquarters, of course, they all speak Japanese. And, you know, it's pretty much the language of music, right? You don't really need words, you know.
So, were there elements of culture shock living there?
Oh, definitely. You know, since I grew up with all this Japanese around me, my dad was he peddled Japanese food on a panel truck that he would drive to Japanese families' homes and sell that, right? So I thought I was totally Japanese. And then I got to Japan and realized how American I was because of the way the culture was, you know, different things were like, right. I mean, one of the stories was about this one police officer that was living with this elderly couple. You know, the elderly couple were friends of my grandparents. So when I went to Japan, I also stayed with them, right? And he told me that his one of his best friends was becoming friendly with the police chief's daughter, right? They were dating, actually. And then her mother came in and said, oh, you must stop this relationship right now because, you know, she is of higher status than you, right, kind of thing. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I mean, what more perfect couple would it be, you know, to have the police chief's daughter go with a police officer because she would understand the life of a police officer. But then, you know, there it's like if you're the different status, you cannot be together, right? Hmm. You know, and I thought, no, that's not right. As an American, I was thinking, you know, well, that doesn't make sense to me, right?
But, now, you mentioned you were at Berklee. You were playing classical guitar then as well?
Oh, I didn't learn classical guitar at Berklee. Actually, I was when I went to Japan, I got a letter mm-hmm. saying, you need one more class to graduate, right? So I said, oh, gosh, I have to go back. So I asked my counselor if I needed to go back to Berklee to do that one more class. And she said, no, you can go to any four-year college. So I decided to go to Cal State Hayward. Well, they call it Cal State East Bay nowadays because mm-hmm. they had a great music department. And I decided to not only take the one more class I needed to, you know, make sure that I satisfied all the requirements, but I decided to have fun with it. So I took classical guitar, I took voice, I took tennis. right? I said, "Wow, this is going to be fun!" Right? So that's when I took guitar. It kind of turned out to be a good thing because I could mm-hmm. get a little more training on other things.
Yeah. And you played violin in school when you were a kid?
I did. From about third grade to my senior year in high school. Yeah. You know how you get rebellious with your parents. And since everything was koto in my family, I said, I'm not playing koto. I'm going to play the violin. And I was in young people's symphony orchestras. And, I was really, you know, thinking I'm going to be a violinist until I heard other violinists that were like 1,000 times better than me. But because I thought the koto was easy, mm-hmm. right? I didn't realize it was easy because it was coming easy to me since I grew up with it.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. So for a while I was, you know, looking toward, you know, violin being my instrument of choice. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Would you be prepared to play another piece for us?
Oh yeah. I forgot about that. Huh? Okay. Let me retune this here. Let's see. Yeah. So this piece is, that I'm going to play is called Tsubasa ni Notte, which means on the wings of a bird. You know, my son is also an excellent koto player, I'm happy to say. You know, the koto was actually played by mostly women. And I kept thinking, you know, I had two sons, so too bad. I didn't think, you know, my sons would be interested. You know, although I wanted them to learn some kind of instrument. You know, of course, since I'm a musician. So when they got to be, you know, about, I don't know, third grade, something like that, I took them to a music shop and I said, hey, what do you want to play? And so my older son, Brian, said, I want to play saxophone, right? Now, my friend was working at the House of Woodwinds in Berklee. Mm-hmm. And he told Brian, he said, don't play the saxophone. Everybody plays the saxophone. You'll never get a job, right? But he goes, I want to play the saxophone. So he played the saxophone, and my second son decided to take drums, right? But excuse me. I knew that Brian was musical. He had a really good ear from, you know, very young. So I taught both of them a little bit of koto, but Brian is the one that kind of you know, stuck to it. And I'm a little, of course, as an American, I'm outside the box, I think, right? And a lot of his koto players who practice and teach in the United States are a little more open-minded about how we share our music because there are very few of us, number one. And number two, we don't think that we should be so regulated to, you know, one school or whatever. So, and this way we can, you know, share our music and, you know, we like each other's music from different schools and we don't have to, you know, be so strict about that. So, my colleague, who was teaching in San Francisco, her name is Shoko Hikage, was of a different koto school, the Sawai school, based in Tokyo. And, the headmaster of that school, Tadao Sawai, was composing some very interesting rhythmic music, modern music. Young people just, you know, loved it. Mm-hmm. And then his wife, Kazue, was, you know, they were like, even though they both played koto, they played different styles of music, which was just incredible. It's an incredible couple. And she would just, she would just mesmerize people with her improvisation, right? So, and she even invited us to come and perform with her in a concert in San Francisco. Now, I thought it was really unusual for a headmaster to say, I want you to invite every koto player in your area to come and join us, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. And I just loved their philosophy and how they were very, very open. So, so I got to play with Kazue Sawai, perform with her and other people from other schools, actually, too. I brought Brian to this concert, and he was just, you know, overwhelmed by Kazue Sawai. So he started taking lessons from her. She invited him to come to their school in Tokyo. And they had a dormitory, they had a workshop, they had all this stuff. He became a live-in student. It's called a uchideshi, which means it's not just you learn how to play the koto. You have to, you know, help clean the house, help bring the kids to school, you know, do these little chores. Whenever there's a concert, you have to bring all the instruments. So he got a really interesting training from the Sawai school. And to me, we were able to learn, you know, we were able to share our different music with each other, right? So there was one piece I just absolutely fell in love with, Tsubasa ni Notte. And I looked all over for the music, but this is a piece that they were keeping for their advanced students. So it wasn't published for everybody else to play. Mm-hmm. So, and Brian loved it so much that he transcribed it from a recording. He listened to both Kazue and Tadao's recording and then, you know, figured it out. Mm-hmm. So now I believe it's been some years since that time, and I think it's published now and people are playing it from other schools. It's just a beautiful piece. And so Brian actually taught me this piece. You know, so I'm happy to say. So I hope you like this piece. I'm playing Tsubasa ni Notte, which means On the Wings of a Bird, by Sawai Tadao. Thank you.
you. Absolutely mesmerizing and really inspiring. Oh. What is the notation like? How is this notated?
Notation. I can show you a book here. This is one of the first books. Let's see it like that.
Wow. Okay. So that looks... For those people who aren't seeing it's nothing like I've ever seen before.
Oh, okay. So basically, it's, you know, Western music is you're playing notes, but because the koto has to be tuned before you play it, it's really numbers. So each string has a number, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 to 10. And then 11, 12, and 13, because in general writing, you write 11 like 10 plus 1 and 10 plus 2 and 10 plus 3. Mm-hmm. There's three different symbols for those three strings. It's read just like Chinese and Japanese, which is basically, you know, open it the opposite way that we open a book. And then you read downward instead of horizontally from right to left. Each box, if you can see it, is one beat. Mm-hmm. A double line means a measure, right? So it's kind of like that.
Okay. And
basically, right? So, yeah. So
you obviously learned Western notation as a violinist. When you write your arrangements, are you writing in the traditional Japanese notation?
For koto, yeah.
Okay. Right.
Sometimes I do write Western arrangements because we play with Western instruments. Sometimes if I'm transcribing, I'll buy some sheet music so I can take a look at what it actually makes it easier for me to arrange because, you know, I can read the music and then figure out the main thing would be for koto is to figure out what your tuning is going to be. Right.
Okay.
And so sometimes since I'm, you know, restricted to 13 strings, I look at the scale and think, okay, if I need more notes, I can get, by, you know, bending notes, getting some more, a little more range that way, right? Sometimes if there's a note that keeps popping up that I'm pressing all the time, I'll tune it to that, right? Instead of having to bend a note to get up to it all the time, right? Yeah.
And do you improvise?
Oh, yeah. Right. But, you know, it's just like I was mentioning before, you know, one of the things I tried to do since I was in a jazz band before was to try to find tunings that fit whatever piece it was, whatever song it was, and to be able to pretty much play whatever on that tuning with that tune.
I guess what I meant, I was worried that you played some jazz in ensembles. I was curious as an individual, if you just improvised in different styles or even in a traditional Japanese style, you know, just to make stuff up. And if you do that as a creative practice.
Oh, a creative practice? I don't really do it as a practice per se, but, you know, I do tell my students to practice doing improvisation because they, you know, then they'll be more freer about it. They won't be, you know, as a lot of people are scared of improvisation, right? I was scared of improvisation because just like many classical musicians, when you're book learned, it's hard to kind of go away from the book in a way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one nice thing about, you know, koto tunings is that you could pretty much play them in any order and it sounds nice, right? You know, so it's a nice instrument to improvise with because, you know, I think like if I was playing violin, I'd be thinking about what scales I'm in, what key signatures and, you know, what I can flat or sharp or whatever. But you, can't do that too much with the koto, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's good to be aware of what your notes are so that you can do those things and you can do more with it then, right? Because you understand, you know, what works in with whatever key signatures or chord, mm-hmm. chordal things, right? But
now when Brian went to Japan to study, I understand your mom wasn't too happy about that, which I found interesting.
Oh, yeah, she wasn't. Remember I was mentioning about the school system, right? Mm-hmm. And how they're pretty strict about trying to keep you within their school, right? So when Brian received his credentials from a different koto school, you know, to me, in my American mind, I'm thinking third generation, right? You know, here's a young person who's going to continue playing koto. And mm-hmm. I know a million other, you know, practitioners of Japanese traditional arts that would love to have their grandchild be continuing what they do, right? But my mother, on the other hand, was very upset because he didn't get his teaching credential under the Chikushi Kai school. So when people, I put a little article in Japanese paper and to announce that so that he can maybe start his own studio and get some students. But and people congratulated my mother and she just went, he is not third generation because he didn't get it from my koto school, right? So since Brian felt bad about that, making grandma mad, he went and got his degree from the Chikushi school as well under his grandmother, right? So she was happy about that. The weird thing is, you know, like here, if you get a degree in, say, you know, one university and get another degree from another university and everybody says, oh, wow, that person's very well-rounded because they've had education from different places. But that's not looked upon as a good thing in the Japanese traditional world, right? They want mm-hmm. you in their school, only that. And, you know, it looks like you're disloyal if you go from one school to the others, right? mm-hmm. Right, so... Yeah, so those are different cultural things, I think, right?
Well, we talked about your cultural shock when you went to Japan to study. What was it like for him? He was only 17.
Well, I guess I'm not sure if I can speak for him, but it was difficult for him because he spoke less Japanese than I did. He actually told me that he didn't eat for the first 2 or 3 days because he didn't know how to ask for food. And when he went into town, you know, in Japan, the restaurants sometimes have these wax models of their food, right? So he kind of went to one of the restaurants and said, I want that.
Oh, no.
And he was finally able to eat, right? So it was pretty difficult at first. And it was funny because he, there was a TV show that did a little spot on that school while he was there. They interviewed, of course, the headmaster and another student. And then they went to Brian and said, oh, he's from America, right? But Brian insisted on trying to speak in Japanese, which was pretty limited. So, you know, I mean, I admire Brian because he's very brave about that. You know, if I'm feeling shy and stuff, I'm not going to try and do the most difficult thing, right? And he actually tries to, in any situation, if we're with someone from Japan, even though our Japanese is not as polished, and, you know, he'll still try and speak to them in the language and as much as he can and stuff. So, mm-hmm. so.
And you made an album with him in 2010.
Yes. Yeah, we did one together called Oyako Don. That's actually a rice dish that has chicken and egg. Mm-hmm. Yeah, oya means you know, parent and child. Oyako, okay. Right? So that's why that dish is called, you know, the chicken and the egg, right? Is in the rice.
Okay. I've seen some of your videos together on YouTube, which were great, but I haven't heard the album. Are you going to maybe put it on Bandcamp or something, or where can people listen to it?
Which album? Oh, that album?
This album, yeah.
Oh. We did it so long ago, right? It's over 10 years ago. I guess maybe because I'm older now, I feel like I'm not, you know, very up on the technology these days. So I'm, and Brian is not a person that is actually worried about, you know, getting his name out there or trying to, you know, do that type of thing. So we're pretty laid back about our approach to doing things. I mean, the strange thing is that, you know, since there are fewer and fewer Koto teachers, especially in the Bay Area, it's almost like we don't have to advertise, right? Because mm-hmm. there aren't that many of us left. So, you know, and that's why my goal has been to make sure that there will be other people after me. And so mm-hmm. I'm training another, you know, very bright student right now to go for her teaching credential next month. So hopefully, mm-hmm. You know, I have another person out there to help keep this music going in this area, right?
And online, you're all teaching online a little bit as
yes,
well?
Yes, I'm teaching online. I have students in Utah and North Carolina. Actually, I have a new student in Bangkok. I can't believe that one. Mm-hmm. Because generally speaking, you know, the traditional way of teaching is in person. And mm-hmm. and for a long time, I said I will never teach by virtually, right? But unfortunately, the pandemic kind of forced us to learn new skills. And even then, when people approached me about learning, I still would like to see them learn in person from somebody. So I tried to scout out and see if there's teachers in their area that they could I could introduce them to, and they could learn from that person who's close by. But it was interesting. The student I have from Bangkok was interesting because she kind of understood that tradition, right? She was saying, you know, is it okay for you to teach somebody who, you know, I don't know. I think she had an instrument herself already. She had all the equipment she needed. And she said that, you know, if she had learned from some other person on, you know, from another school, something like this, you have to kind of, there's the etiquette of going to that teacher and saying, you know, I would like to learn from this teacher instead. Mm-hmm. You know, there has to be some consent to that, right? These kind of things. You know, she plays the guzheng, actually, the Chinese version of mm-hmm. the koto. And so I said, well, you know, what is it that you really want to do? And she likes my jazz koto music, and she wanted to be mm-hmm. able to do something like that, right, on the koto. And I said, hey, I think you could do that on the guzheng, since you already know how to play the guzheng. And I said, you know, so I tried to encourage her to maybe, I'll give you some pointers, and you do what I do, except for on the guzheng, right? But she said she loves the sound of the koto, and that's why she bought a koto. She was on a homestay thing, right, you know, high school. So she bought a koto while she was there and brought it back with mm-hmm. her to Bangkok, including finger picks and everything. And she's been dying to learn the koto. So there you go, right?
Wonderful. Well, I just want to thank you for today, sharing your family history, your love of music, and the important history of the music in the internment camps as well. And I encourage everyone to watch that, Hidden Legacies. It'll be linked, of course, in the description.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thanks for following the series on your favorite podcast player and sharing your favorite episodes with your friends, all of which help find new listeners. I have lots more episodes coming in this season 3 with a fascinating diversity of musicians and their stories and music. Have a great week. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or €2, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description.